Good morning. Thanks for joining us online. We are in the book of Daniel, and we are currently in Daniel chapter 7. And so we're starting to get into a portion of Daniel that is going to be pretty confusing because it's a series of dreams and visions that God gives to Daniel about what is to come. Now, Daniel chapter 1 through 6 is more of a kind of historical recount of what's happening in this time. And it kind of centers around the person of Daniel. But for any newcomers or just really for us to kind of come and realize where we are at this particular point, I'm just going to go through a quick overview of these first six chapters. So just kind of come along with me in this journey through Daniel's life, in a sense. And so in the first half of Daniel, Daniel chapter 1 through 6, we see it starts with the deportation of the Jews from Jerusalem, right? They are being sent into exile in Babylon, judgment of God on Israel. And so they're sent into exile. Daniel is one of these young men who's actually invited to be part of the royal court. He's invited to become one of the wise men, and he consecrates himself. He understands his identity as God's people. And he preserves that identity. And because of that, he has favor from God that causes him to rise in stature and influence in ranking, even in this Babylonian empire. And so we see he becomes an advisor to King Nebuchadnezzar, mainly because he's able to interpret two of these dreams that King Nebuchadnezzar has. And so we see that King Nebuchadnezzar, being the king of the Babylonian Empire, he has two separate dreams. And both times, Daniel is able to interpret this dream for him. So King Nebuchadnezzar has seen the power of the God of the Jews, right? He understands how powerful this God is. Not only that, but he's seen how God delivered Daniel's friends from the fiery furnace. If you remember, in Daniel chapter 3, three of his friends were thrown into the fiery furnace because they refused to bow down to the statue of King Nebuchadnezzar, and God delivers them. And then, even though King Nebuchadnezzar has seen all of this, even though he recognizes the power and the authority of this God, he still continues down this path of pride and arrogance. And because of that, God actually renders judgment on him. Right? God gives warning after warning, and then he renders judgment. And we realize in Daniel chapter 4 that God gives him over he becomes a madman, right? He's driven into the wild. He lives among the beasts until, it says, when he came to his senses and he honored the God of heaven, then God restored him to his kingdom. And then shortly after that, there's an abrupt transition to King Belshazzar, who's kind of throwing this feast, and you know he has heard and he's known kind of the lesson that King Nebuchadnezzar has learned, and yet he chooses to defile particularly the religious items of the Jewish temple, opposing God, even though he knew about the God of the Jews, he knew about the God of heaven, and yet he chose to go down the same path of pride and arrogance. He did not learn the lesson that King Nebuchadnezzar had taught him, but he went down this similar path. And then it said during this feast, there was a hand that appeared that wrote on the wall. And Daniel, once again, is summoned. He's able to interpret it, basically telling King Belshazzar, you knew all these things, yet you did not change. You did not change course, and so judgment is coming. And then that chapter ends that very night the king was killed. And then we see this transition from the Babylonian Empire into the Medo-Persian Empire, where Darius the Mede comes in. And this was where we were last week, Daniel in the lion's den, where Daniel is thrown into the lion's den because of the king's edict. And Darius, despite his power, despite his military might, he's unable to deliver Daniel from the lion's den. And we see that ultimately the crux of this passage is that God is the true deliverer. He is the true king. He is the only one able to deliver Daniel from the lion's den. So throughout the book of Daniel so far, we've seen how Daniel has risen in favor and in stature. And it's largely because of God. God has caused him to be able to be an advisor to multiple kings and to multiple empires. And so now here we are in Daniel chapter 7. And again, the second half of Daniel is a series of visions and dreams that God has given to himself. Okay? So before we get into this vision of Daniel chapter 7, I just want to start out by pointing out a few things to couch this sermon and perhaps the ones following this one. First of all, with eschatology, the study of end times, and apocalyptic literature, which Daniel is a part of this, I understand there's a lot of room for interpretation, and there's a lot of room for error on some of these details. Now, depending on your view of the end times, you and I, we can come to different conclusions on what visions and dreams mean. Actually, earlier this week, I was talking with Pastor Peter, and we have differing views of eschatology. So we have different interpretations of what these visions mean. But without getting into all the complexities of the different views, I'm just going to explain two basic views, okay? Two camps and their views of eschatology. The first view is the preterist view. Okay, the preterist view, sometimes you'll hear the term amillennialism. This view believes that these end time prophecies, these visions and dreams that Daniel has, they have already been fulfilled, right? In the between 7th century BC and 70 AD, which was the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, between this time frame, all of these end times prophecies have already been fulfilled. Now, the second view is the futurist view, or some of you may have heard the term premillennialism. And this view believes that these end time prophecies, they could have already happened in this time period, but there's this thing called multiple fulfillment, where it happens again, and then it can happen again. So the futurist view believes that these end times prophecies and dreams and what is to happen will actually happen in one shape or form somewhere down the line before the second coming of Jesus. Now, to give you an example of that, if you remember in Matthew chapter 24, I believe, Jesus is talking to his disciples and they're saying, when are you going to come? How will we recognize your second coming? And he says, to give an example, the abomination of desolation, which I'll explain a little bit more later, this was going to be one of the signposts of his return. Now, the abomination of desolation, it actually happened twice already. Okay, it happened twice. In 168 BC, the Greek king, King Antiochus, he came and he invaded Jerusalem. He captured the city and he went into the temple and he erected a statue of Zeus. And then he slaughtered a pig on the altar of incense, defiling the temple. So that was the what was referred to as abomination of desolation. The second time it happened was actually after Jesus. It was 70 AD. General Titus of Rome came, invaded the city, destroyed the temple. And so these kind of two things are kind of happened once, happened again, and then futurist view is that in one shape or another, it's going to happen one more time because Jesus said, this will be the sign before I return. So that's the futurist view. And on a side note, you know, futurists are actually pretty invested in what happens with Israel. And so they're kind of invested in what's happening with Israel, mainly because there's this belief that all these prophecies or visions and dreams point to Israel being a part of it. And, you know, we can't deny that after all these years, Israel is still around. And so, that's kind of the futurist view. This morning, I'm going to be preaching from a futurist view, a futurist perspective. And again, I understand that some of you may have a different perspective on this than I do. And so I'm going to come with you and try to faithfully explain this text from this view, but also with humility, understanding that we can come to different conclusions on the specifics. But my hope is that after I explain it to you, I'm going to come and just kind of bring out some main points, some main themes, some main realities that I think all of us can agree on. And, you know, it's going to be a very technical sermon. There's going to be a lot of kind of explaining I need to do. So kind of the layout of this morning, I'm just going to go through the stream systematically. I'm going to go through each of the beasts that are mentioned and then and this vision of the Son of Man approaching the Ancient of Days. And then I'll wrap up with, again, these main points that I think we can agree on. So if you have your Bibles with you, I encourage you to open up Daniel chapter 7, because I will be going through it kind of systematically. I won't have all the verses on the screen, but it could help you to kind of look at the text as we go along, okay? Now, this chapter starts out in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. So from this point on, it's no longer chronological, but the emphasis is on the dreams and visions that God is giving Daniel for what is to come. First of all, let me remind you, there's two differing views of the four kingdoms. I mentioned this in King Nebuchadnezzar's first dream, Daniel chapter 2. There are four kingdoms that made up the statue in this dream, and the four beasts actually correspond with the four components of this statue in the dream. Again, the statue of Nebuchadnezzar is composed of a head of gold, right? Silver chest and arms, a bronze thigh, legs and feet of iron and clay. Okay, that's King Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And there's a correspondence in this chapter of the four beasts. But these four kingdoms, people come to different conclusions. One is the Roman view and one is the Greek view. And depending on which view you adapt, the kingdoms differ. But I don't think we need to get too caught up with those two views because, ultimately that dream was about the rock that was not cut from human hands and how it smashes into the statue. It's about the kingdom of God that will not be destroyed. But to let you know, I'm going to explain this passage from the Roman view. And so that is the four kingdoms from the Roman view is Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and then Rome. Babylon being the head of gold, Medo-Persia being the chest and arms of silver, Greece being the legs and thighs of bronze, and Roman being the feet of iron and clay. So as we look at this dream, there's, again, this correspondence, right, with the statue of these precious metals and of these four different beasts. And something interesting to note is that in King Nebuchadnezzar's dream, these kingdoms are made up of these precious metals. And I think from a human perspective, from man's perspective, it's that of precious commodities, right? Gold, silver, bronze, iron, and clay. Our kingdoms are made of precious commodities, right? And that's kind of oftentimes our perspective. When we're building kingdoms, we look at how precious this is. But it's interesting because in Daniel's dream, from God's perspective, these four kingdoms are beasts that come and devour and destroy and trample over everything in its path. And I think from heaven's perspective, this is indicative of the fact that when we're left to ourselves, because of the destructive nature of sin and the rampant kind of spread of sin, these kingdoms, our human kingdoms, are like beasts that go and just cause chaos and confusion and are destructive in nature. And that's the difference between human perspective and God's perspective. Now, let's go through this dream, and I'm going to stop at each beast, and we'll take a look at each of them. But verse 4 says, "The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being. And the mind of a human was given to it." Now, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, they're two Old Testament prophets. They actually refer to Babylon as a lion and an eagle. And this image of a lion with an eagle paints this picture of Babylon that is powerful in its conquest and its military speed. The second part of this verse gives us a clue that it's referring to King Nebuchadnezzar. Its wings were torn off, right? This is when God humbles King Nebuchadnezzar and drives him into the wild. And then it goes on and says that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. Now remember, God humbled King Nebuchadnezzar, but when he came to his senses, he was restored to his seat on the throne. And so this first beast represents Babylon and King Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 5, as we continue, there's the second beast. "There before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.'" Now, this is the Medo-Persian Empire. Right, the bear is slower, but nevertheless, it is vast, it is large and powerful in its own might. And this represents the Medo-Persian Empire because this empire did not conquer as quickly as Babylon did, but slowly and steadily it became a vast empire. The beast being raised up on one of its side represents the fact that the Persian Empire was actually the stronger of the two. King Cyrus actually reneged on his partnership with the Median Empire, and ultimately the Persian Empire kind of took over. And so this depiction of the bear being raised on one side is almost as if King Cyrus is overtaking the Median Empire. And the 3 ribs in its mouth represents the 3 major kingdoms that it had to conquer in order to establish its vast empire. These three being Lydia in 546 BC, Babylon in 539 BC, and then Egypt in 520, 525 BC. And it was told to get up, eat your fill of flesh, and it was told to conquer more nations and more territory. So the second beast that we see is the Medo-Persian Empire, and the face of this empire being King Cyrus. The third beast, verse 6, after that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back it had four wings like those of a bird. This beast had four heads, and it was given authority to rule. This was the Grecian Empire, the Greeks. This beast had four heads, and it was given authority to rule. They were incredibly agile, fast. I mean, think about a leopard, how fast they are. And in this vision, this leopard has four wings, how fast it was. And it certainly spoke to how fast the Grecian Empire was able to establish itself. I mean, in 12 short years, 13 years, Alexander the Great was able to conquer this vast empire that stretched more than 3,000 miles wide. Now, Alexander the Great actually died at a very young age, at the age of 32. And at that point of his death, his four generals that were part of this campaign ended up dividing up the kingdom to four different kingdoms. And so this represents why the beast has four separate heads. The four heads of the beast, the four parts of the kingdom, were Antipater and later Cassander, who gained control of Greece and Macedonia, Lysimachus, who ruled Thrace and a large part of the Asia Minor, Seleucus governed Syria, Babylon, and much of the Middle East, and Ptolemy controlled Egypt and Palestine. Okay, so those are the four. You don't have to remember all those names. Just remember Alexander the Great. He is kind of the face of the Grecian Empire. So this third beast represents Greece and Alexander the Great. This last beast in verse chapter 7 says, after that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. This is a beast that was different than all the prior beasts in the vision. I mean, Daniel had an idea of what these first three beasts were, but with this four beasts, he doesn't even, you know, name it because he doesn't know what it is. It had 10 horns. It had iron teeth and bronze claws, and it crushed and devoured its victims, and it trampled underfoot whatever was left. Daniel actually, later on, as he approaches this angel to get an interpretation for this, he asked specifically about this fourth beast because it was disturbing to him. It was just kind of just out, like, wild to him. And so this fourth beast represented a ruthless kingdom that brought a lot of destruction and chaos. It represents the Roman Empire, which indeed was ruthless and powerful, inflicting a lot of pain actually to the Jewish people. But this beast in the future's view is not just the Roman Empire, but it represents an end-time empire that will be established before the second coming of Jesus. Now, I mentioned earlier the abomination of desolation in Matthew chapter 24. These disciples are coming up to him and they're asking, when will the sign be of the coming and of your coming and the end of this age? And then Jesus says, many will come claiming they are the Messiah. Many will come and many things will happen that will cause people to be alarmed and thinking it is the end. But he actually references the abomination of desolation in Daniel, where he says, when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. And so one of the signposts for his return is this abomination of desolation. And again, this happened once with the Greek king Antiochus, but it also happened with General Titus of Rome in 70 AD. But the futurist perspective is that it will happen in one shape or another, before the second coming of Jesus. We don't know what that's going to look like, but that is one of the signposts before Jesus comes back. I don't know if you're thoroughly confused, but let's go on. So we can speculate, we can only speculate what this end time empire is going to look like. From this text, we'll just look at this text, this beast, this empire is different than the others. It's exceedingly terrifying and brutal. It's ruthless and more destructive than all of the beasts before it. And we see that it says there are 10 horns that kind of are on this beast. And then it mentions that in verse 24, that the explanation of these 10 horns is that it represents 10 different kings. So 10 horns representing 10th king. But then there's this small horn, this 11th horn that comes into the picture. And I want to take a moment to focus on this 11th horn because it's small and insignificant, but it comes and it's able to subdue 3 out of the 10 horns. It comes and subdues 3 out of the 10 kings. And in John's vision in the book of Revelation, there's also 10 horns, which represents 10 kings, and they give authority to the beast to wage war against the Lamb, which is Jesus. So in Revelation, it's this beast in this vision in Daniel, we call it the 11th horn, okay? For those of you that are familiar with the Left Behind series, I think the popular terminology is the Antichrist, right? Which actually is not found in these apocalyptic literatures. First and second John do talk about many antichrists have already come. A lowercase antichrist, lowercase a for antichrist, basically people who oppose the believers. But it's this idea that there will be a figure who will lead the charge against God's people. And so when we look at this, we actually see that, again, in the Revelation, it's referred to as the beast, but I'm going to refer to it as the 11th horn because that's what this vision that Daniel receives is about. So I know it's kind of a little bit hard to picture what that could look like. So let me try to personify this 11th horn by giving an example that I recently heard about. One example of a leader that may have been considered to be the 11th horn or was like the 11th horn is none other than Hitler. You know, Hitler was a leader who was small and insignificant when he first started. When he ran for president of Germany, he only got 2% of the vote. But within 5 years, he actually became the chancellor of Germany. And we see how his quick and surprising rise in power came very suddenly, and it was very surprising for many. And I'm sure in that time, many believers were probably looking at Revelation and wondering, is Hitler this 11th horn? Is he the beast, the Antichrist, the one who's setting the stage for the second coming of Christ? You know, if this is a shadow of what could be coming, I can certainly understand why Daniel would be so troubled, why he would be so disturbed, because there's so much death and chaos and destruction that is happening in this empire. One thing that we notice about the horn is this word boastful, right? This horn speaks boastfully. 3 times in the chapter, it mentions the small horn spoke boastfully. It's full of pride and arrogance, which we see as a theme with human kings, right? King Nebuchadnezzar, King Belshazzar. This small horn is full of pride and arrogance. And, you know, it's a pattern of human rebellion against God. We see this all throughout Scripture. One where we wrongfully boast in our human wisdom and our human intellect. But it says the words of this 11th horn are going to be powerful. Powerful in the sense that his words are going to create great fear and great excitement in people, right? Great fear because his words that threaten and oppress the people of God, but great excitement because of the false promises to allure people, to rally against the people of God. Now, going back to the 10 horns that were part of this beast representing the 10 kings, it looks like there's going to be some type of confederation of 10 nations or 10 leaders who's going to be extremely powerful. And then this 11th horn, this small and insignificant horn, comes into the picture. This leader comes into the picture, and I don't know how he does it, but he subdues or overthrows 3 out of those 10 kings. And so, you know, all of a sudden everyone is kind of like in awe or kind of in wonder or terrified of what's happening. And so dominion transfers from these 10 leaders to this 11th leader, this 11th horn. And he is given great power and ability to consolidate a movement. And in verse 25, it says, he will speak against the Most High God and oppress his holy people and try to change the set times and the laws. So by his authority, whether it's through legislation, whether it's through decree or influence, I don't know how he's going to do it, but he will oppress God's people, and God's people will be given into his hands for a time, times, and half a time. Now, just on a side note, my personal theory is that people who hold to this futurist view are actually likely to be more concerned about government overreach because they look at these visions and these dreams, and it's not just about protecting individual personal freedom, but really this concern of this consolidation of power. That when an unlimited amount of power and authority is given to a central figure, when it falls into the wrong hands, there's going to be great suffering and persecution. And before we dismiss it, I mean, just throughout human history, that's typically what happened, case after case, where you know, a central figure who has consolidated an incredible amount of power is able to cause great suffering and destruction. So as we continue on in this chapter, that's the end of the fourth beast, this beast that is different than the others. And then this vision transitions from the beasts to this setting in heaven. And Daniel is still thinking about these horns, but he's brought to the scene where he sees the Ancient of Days. And in case it's not clear, this is God. God's sitting on his throne. And in verse 9, we read, "As I looked," Daniel says, "as I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were still ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were open." So Daniel sees a heavenly court that is in session, and all eyes are on the Ancient of Days, the one who is pure in all his ways, full of eternal wisdom and power and authority. And yet this small horn, who compared to the Ancient of Days has no power, still continues to speak boastfully until it says the beast was slain and thrown into the blazing fire. This reminds you of Revelation 19, the picture of the beast and the false prophet being thrown into the lake of fire. But after the scene, verse 13 says, "There before me was one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him, and his dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. His kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." Now, in the middle of this chapter, we get our first look at the person of Jesus. Right? This is, again, hundreds of years before the coming of Jesus. This vision and this dream is hundreds of years before Jesus actually arrives, but it's pointing to the one who has been given all authority, all glory, all power, and all might. This phrase, Son of Man, can actually be translated as a human or human being, a man. And this part of the vision must have been confusing to Daniel for several reasons. First of all, Daniel points out the fact that this Son of Man was coming with the clouds of heaven because it's such a bizarre sight to see. This being that approaches God is ultimately a human being. And Daniel cannot comprehend the fact that the reality is that this being would be a human. Second of all, to see a human-like figure coming on the clouds would have disrupted his Jewish paradigm, because at the time, the Jewish paradigm was that all human beings, when they died, they would actually descend into Sheol, okay? I know right now we think, believers would go to heaven and non-believers would go to hell, and there's a separation there, but at the time, the Jewish paradigm is all people descend into Sheol, and Sheol had two compartments. One was called Abraham's bosom, for the righteous, and then the other was the lake of eternal fire, which was for the wicked. And so to see a human being coming in the clouds from heaven from above was just such a bizarre sight for him to see. It would have been puzzling, a puzzling sight to see. Third of all, a human being approaching the throne of God and not being utterly destroyed would have been just so confusing. If you remember with Moses, when Moses says, "Show me your glory," and God says, "I'm going to hide you in the cleft of this rock while I pass by, and you can see my glory in that way, because no one can comprehend the fullness of my glory without dying." So Daniel would have wondered how this human being could come into the presence of God and not be destroyed. And lastly, Judaism is a monotheistic religion, and it's not like Babylon where there's a pantheon of gods. So to see a second figure be given this authority and to be worshipped by the nations would have just, you know, completely have been something that was mind-boggling for him. Now, you know, Daniel does not understand what is happening here. But for us, this is a prophetic revelation of the person of Jesus. It's talking about the one who is going to be established as the king of the kingdom, Jesus. One of Jesus' favorite and most common references to himself was Son of Man. He referred to himself as the Son of Man from the book of Daniel. And in Matthew's gospel account, this is actually one of the last things that he says. As he's standing in trial, if you remember, there's false witnesses coming and their evidence is not lining up. It's not being corroborated. All these false witnesses are saying these things and about Jesus, but they're all falling short. And then the high priest comes forward, and in Matthew 26, verse 63 to 64, says, the high priest said to Jesus, I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. And Jesus replies, you have said so. But I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. So Daniel may not have understood who this Son of Man in the vision was, but from our perspective, we can see how this Son of Man is Jesus. Because Jesus is the Son of Man, the Son of God. And this is important to Christian doctrine, that Jesus was fully human and fully God. And he is the Son of Man, the Son of God, who has been given the keys to the kingdom. He is the king of this kingdom that will not be destroyed. Every knee shall bow. Every tongue shall confess and worship him. Every tribe, every nation, every people group will worship him. And that's the end of the vision. Daniel is, you know, needless to say, troubled in his spirit. It said that the visions that passed through his mind disturbed him. And he approaches the angel to ask what the meaning of all of this is. Now, as we wrap up this morning, I want to share some things that we can hopefully agree on. But why this vision, right? Why does God give these dreams and visions that are so complex? And we wonder about, you know, why is it happening this way? Or what does this mean, right? Why is it so hard to hold on to? And I wish I could tell you the answer to that, but, you know, as with many other questions we have about life itself, in God's infinite wisdom and from his perspective, we don't need to be concerned about we don't need to know all the details. One day we will see clearly, and we take solace in the fact that even though we don't understand now, as we learn to trust in him, to love him, and to trust in his leadership, we will one day come to understand, oh, that's why you did things the way you did. I think that is how we approach this. So again, you don't have to agree with me on all the details regarding the interpretation of this vision, but again, I'm going to emphasize three points that hopefully we can agree on. The first is this. Though Daniel may be fixated on the fourth beast because of how terrifying and how horrific this fourth beast was, I think the focus of this passage is actually the scene where the Son of Man is being given authority and power and glory by the Ancient of Days. See, oftentimes our mind goes to what terrifies us the most. We are people that are fearful, anxious. We worry about what is going to happen. We're constantly afraid. And God always has to say, do not fear. Do not be afraid. And oftentimes our mind goes to play out the worst case scenario in our lives. And this is certainly what Daniel is doing in this particular moment where he's just fixated on the fourth beast. And he goes to his angel and he asks for the interpretation, and the angel interprets it for him, but he's redirected in verse 26. It says, but the court will sit. His power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. All right, this fourth beast, this empire, the power and authority from it will be completely destroyed forever. And then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. Though there may come terrifying times, we learn to fix our eyes on Jesus. And that is, I think, the crux of this passage, that the reality of the kingdom of God, once again, is that it is an eternal one, that all other kingdoms will fade away, just like King Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. And even though these four beasts are terrifying, these four empires seem to be invincible in their time, the reality is that all of them will eventually lose their power and authority. And if there's anything we can agree on, it's that as we are in this grand story, this grand story tells us that Jesus has been given the keys to the kingdom. The Son of Man, the Son of God, will establish his kingdom forever, for all of eternity. So that's the first point that hopefully we can all agree on in regards to this vision. A second point I think we see is that there is a cosmic struggle that is happening. Sometimes when we don't recognize it, it's happening in the spiritual realm, but it bleeds into the natural realm as well. In fact, a few chapters later, Daniel is praying and fasting and seeking the Lord for vision, for understanding, and angel is dispatched from heaven, but is stopped by the prince of Persia. And there's kind of this demonic opposition that's happening in the spiritual realm that even though we don't understand, we recognize that there is a cosmic struggle that is happening. The Bible talks about a great tribulation that will happen before the coming of Jesus. And again, there's different views on it, whether it will happen at all, or if the believers will be raptured before it or, you know, after it. We can differ on those details. But I think the reality is that Jesus says, don't be surprised when you face opposition. Don't be surprised when the world hates you on account of me. Don't be surprised when you face persecution. And, you know, I know we haven't really faced persecution at the levels that other believers around the world may be facing right now. But he says, don't be surprised. And rather, take comfort knowing that the end is written, that the Lamb shall overcome. Lastly, this is more of an application point, but we need to have a real and living relationship with Jesus. This is so important because without relationship, it will be so difficult, impossible, I think, to persevere in the face of persecution, in the face of trials and tribulations. In the parable of the four soil that Jesus talks about, this is the rocky soil, right? The rocky soil that receives the word joyfully, but because it has no roots, because it has no depth, because it has no relationship. It says, when trouble or persecution comes because of the word, they quickly fall away. And when I read passages like this, I'm faced with the sobering reality that many will fall away because they have no relationship, because there is not a real and living relationship with Jesus. And so, brothers and sisters, this morning as we wrap up, let's cultivate the soil of our heart. Let's learn to fix our eyes on Jesus no matter what is to come. In the good and the bad, we place our hope and our trust in him. We trust in his perfect leadership. And as we cultivate the soil of our heart, I pray that we would have a living and real relationship with the King of Kings, Jesus, the Son of Man, the Son of God, who has been given the keys to the eternal kingdom. Amen.